On Capitol Hill today, there were three hearings focusing on the collapse of Enron. In the House, the chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, Republican Billy Tozen, opened a hearing by saying his staff had already uncovered quite a lot.
We have found substantial evidence of illegal activity by Enron and its management. And this activity served to deceive the public about Enron's financial condition. It artificially pumped up Enron's stock price and allowed these same executives to enrich themselves with the sales of Enron stock.
Tozen's committee is looking into broad issues, the relationship between Enron management and its board of directors, and what needs to be done to reform the relationship between companies and their auditors. Two of Enron's top executives, Jeffrey Skilling and Andrew Fastow, are scheduled to testify tomorrow. It's not clear how much these two will be willing to tell, but Tozen and other committee members say they can count on some tough questioning.
The Enron debacle is an old-fashioned example of theft by insiders and a failure of those responsible for them to prevent that theft. We believe this is a huge aberration of corporate behavior in America.
So far in the Enron investigation, much of the attention has focused on former chairman Kenneth Lay, but other top executives played a major role in shaping Enron's corporate culture. It was a business culture that built Enron into the seventh largest company in the country, but it also eventually led the company to bankruptcy. NPR's Wade Goodwin reports from Houston.
During the last decade, if you were young, driven, and very smart, at the top of your class at Stanford or Wharton Business School, and you wanted to make a lot of money, Enron was a good place to land. In return for the opportunity to get rich, you'd work long days under intense pressure, and you had to produce.
I thought it was great. I enjoyed the people I worked with. I enjoyed every moment I spent at Enron.
This man, we'll call him Jim, worked at Enron for 7 years until he was laid off when the company collapsed in December. He spoke only on condition of anonymity. It was Jim's job to check up on Enron's acquisitions, making sure the companies and properties Enron purchased were worth what Enron was paying. Jim says that at Enron, managers were encouraged to believe that any deal was possible.
They thought they were so brilliant they could overcome any obstacle. That's what we were doing. We were doing deals that no one else had done before. We were taking risks that no one else had taken before. And they thought they could manage those risks.
During the 1990s, Enron's energy trading operation became a huge moneymaker. Managers gradually came to believe that with their hard work, brains, and aggressive style, Enron could turn a profit trading just about anything. The company's chief cultural architect was the company's chief operating officer, Jeffrey Skilling. Skilling was a senior partner at the consulting firm McKinsey & Company when Enron CEO Ken Lay stole him away. It was Skilling who came up with the idea of creating a natural gas bank. This bank allowed Enron to buy and sell natural gas for future delivery to companies that wanted to lock in good prices in a volatile market. It was a seminal idea, and it transformed Enron into a trading powerhouse. And Skilling had other ideas, too. Ideas about how Enron should be run.
This culture did not pop out of a hat. It was developed by people like Jeff Skilling and other trading types who came in and created this very aggressive kind of attack dog attitude. They were always in your face. They were very, very good at gaming the system.
John Olson is a senior vice president and director of research for the securities firm Sanders Morris Harris in Houston. Olson's relationship with Enron and its predecessor companies dates back 30 years. Olson says Jeffrey Skilling brought to Enron a new business philosophy: get in quickly, make your money, and get out. Deal-making was in, and Enron aggressively began using something called mark-to-market accounting. On long-term contracts, the company claimed a large percentage of a deal's future profits as current income.
They were doing mark-to-market accounting in amazing places, in regulated utilities, pipelines, power plants. The culture started feeding on itself. They had this tremendous quarterly bonus system where they would pay people loads of money if they delivered or exceeded their quarterly targets.
If it looked like a division would fall short of its earnings goal, Enron managers would sometimes reassess the value of its long-term energy contracts, reassess these contracts upward in order to make the goal. On average, the natural gas business grows at 2% a year, power companies at 3% a year. But at Enron, the plan was to grow at a rate of 15% a year. If you didn't hit your earnings mark, if you couldn't produce, you were out the door. Every 6 months, employees were evaluated. Up or out was the standard of judgment. But a growth rate of 15% a year proved to be beyond even Enron's motivated workforce. John Olson says the unrealistic expectations, combined with management's misguided belief that Enron could succeed at almost anything, eventually led the company into making mistake after mistake.
The trouble was that it was unsustainable. They kept on reaching for things which didn't work, and they could not any longer subsidize their mistakes by burying the bodies in their trading operation. Almost nothing else worked for them besides trading.
Enron lost billions investing in a power plant in India, a huge water project in Argentina, and its investments in internet bandwidth were a complete disaster. Olson says that for a while, Enron covered up its problems by having its profitable trading operation absorb losses and debt. Then came the infamous partnerships, engineered by Chief Financial Officer Andrew Fastow, to bury even more debt. Enron was still reporting robust growth, but Olson says it's now clear it was all a mirage.
The problem was that the culture soon overcame all of the normal checks and balances in the company. Instead of a company that was moving along at 10 miles an hour, the company moved at 50, 60, 70, 80 miles an hour at the end. And when they went off into bankruptcy, they went off at 80 miles an hour.
Last February, Enron's stock started to slide. In response, Ken Lay, Jeff Skilling, and Andy Fastow formed a united front and argued that Wall Street was wrong, that the company was doing just fine. But the pressure was building. Last spring, in a conference call with analysts, Skilling exploded in anger when one analyst asked about the partnerships. To everyone's surprise, Skilling called the analyst a profanity. A few months later, Skilling resigned, saying he wanted to spend more time with his family. It was August of 2001, and Enron was beginning to unravel, but only a few insiders knew the truth. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Houston.